Now we're going to move on to another vegetable, cannabis. Our guest today is Dr. William Courtney. He has an extensive medical education. He studied microbiology at the University of Michigan. He received his Doctor of Medicine from Wayne State University. He was a resident in psychiatry. He went on to earn a postdoctorate in forensic examination and forensic medicine. And he is now internationally renowned as an expert in non-psychoactive dietary uses of cannabis. He is on so many societies having to do with cannabinoids that I will spare you the entire list. Suffice to say, we are very privileged to have him in the studio with us today. Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, William.
Thank you very much.
How did you go from being a psychiatrist and having earned a postdoctorate in forensic medicine, how did you go from that to getting interested in non-psychoactive uses of cannabis?
It started out, I was quite a skeptic in the area of cannabis, and a fellow that I went to medical school with asked if I would approve of his use, and I didn't really understand what it was about, and I declined because I understood the recreational commercial, but I didn't understand the medical. But that was enough of a kind of motivation to begin looking at it. And it was around 2004 that the Scientific American had an article on marijuana, the brain's own marijuana. And it was a very interesting. It talked about these endogenous cannabinoids that we produce in our body that provide feedback in the nervous system. They actually conduct information from the postsynaptic nerve back to the presynaptic and kind of close that loop. And for 30 years, I thought information only flowed in a single direction, and suddenly these cannabinoids that the human body produces actually provide feedback regulation. But it turns out not only in the nervous system, but it looks like in every cell of the body. The uses of cannabis, in particular the evolution from dried to fresh and the non-psychoactive, began with my patients who have been using cannabis for 10, 20, 30 years and have developed some very unusual insights as to alternative uses of the plant. I took that information and then started going to the research societies and looking for mechanisms of action to be able to explain the results that I was seeing in my clinical practice.
Give us some examples of some of the things that you learned from your patients as you were making the transition from being a forensic medicine specialist to being a non-psychoactive uses of cannabis specialist.
One of my early patients was using dried leaf and capsules to reduce the frequency of her migraines. And she was having she was reducing that incidence by up to 90%. And I was impressed with the fact that she was doing this ground up leaf three times a day, had no psychoactive effect, and yet was having this dramatic effect on this migraine condition that she had suffered decades with.
Let me underline something that you said and to make sure I understood it. You're saying that in ingesting this dried leaf in capsules, she was having no psychoactive effect. You're quite certain of that.
If you use the leaf and you keep the leaf cool, if you use the leaf, you dry it and store it at room temperature, over months the leaf will become psychoactive. But as long as the leaf is relatively fresh or kept in a cool state like the refrigerator or possibly the freezer, then you keep the cannabinoid, which is THC acid, stable, and it's a non-psychoactive molecule. The major issue here is the conversion of THC acid, which is found in the raw plant, which is non-psychoactive. Once that's heated, and that heat includes room temperature. If you store cannabis at room temperature over weeks and months, it will become increasingly psychoactive because there will be a breakdown of that THC acid into THC, which is the psychoactive molecule.
So if I understand you correctly, when a person drives down the highway and they might see asparagus, they might see broccoli, they might see kale, they might see marijuana plants, none of those are psychoactive, including the marijuana plant. So if a person were to get out of their car and go over and munch on the broccoli or munch on the asparagus or munch on the marijuana plant, they're not going to have a psychoactive effect from any of those. Is that correct?
That is correct.
It's only, you're saying, when you take these vegetables and heat them up, or in the case of marijuana, as you're pointing out, if you let it sit in a certain way over a certain period of time, that something in it converts to a psychoactive substance. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And science bears out what you're saying. This isn't just your professional opinion over time, but there's scientific evidence to back this.
And intellectual property. In September of 2010, a patent issued on the medicinal acidic cannabinoids. And those are the cannabinoids, THC acid, CBD acid. Those are the chemicals found in the unheated plant. And those are easily broken down by heat, which is why they do break down slowly at room temperature. But for every 10 degrees of increased temperature, the reaction rate doubles. And if you smoke it, vaporize it, steep it, put it in butter, anything that you do that involves strong heat is very quick to completely convert the non-psychoactive THC acid into the psychoactive THC.
So it's actually a conversion process, and when your patient was taking the raw vegetable matter, she was not ingesting a psychoactive substance.
Correct.
Did you then go on and look at what the mechanisms were within the brain that connected with the ingested vegetable in order to get an understanding of how this affected her migraines or reduced her migraines, what the mechanism was?
Over the next 5 to 6 years, I attended almost every conference that I could get to, and the International Cannabinoid Research Society meets in Europe 1 year and then meets in North America another year. There's also the International Cannabis as Medicine, and then there are various specific physiologic conferences. And my whole interest in going to these was to understand the role of raw cannabis. There are not a lot of people out there interested in this raw plant because they're interested in synthetic molecules, patented products, something that they can put on the market shelf that has that can generate financial benefits. And the problem with cannabis is you can grow it like broccoli. You can grow it in the field. You can make rope. You can make canvas. You can make oils for powering cars.
Clothing.
It's, yeah, everything. Paper. Yes. I mean, money is made out of it because it's such a durable paper.
Yes.
And so you have a product which does not have a champion because it can't be controlled and used to make, you know, the traditional pharmaceutical profits. So what happens is we study the plant, and then we immediately try to make a synthetic version, which then can become a patented product and introduced into the marketplace.
Let's get back to your patients now. So you're going through this period you told us about, and here's one example you gave of a patient who was on her own just taking raw vegetable and somehow making it small enough to get into capsules. Because the reason I say not grinding up is because the grinding process alone, since it creates friction, could theoretically heat up the cannabis and make it psychoactive. Is that correct?
That is correct. She was actually drying the leaf and then putting it into a grinder and turning it into a very fine flour and packaging that in the capsules.
How did she know how many to take? She was like an experimental subject of one, wasn't she?
There is a lot of experimenting going on in Mendocino and Humboldt. And these are people who have very active lifestyles. They have arthritis, rheumatoid and osteo, and post-traumatic. And these are people out there struggling to manage their conditions and are definitely conducting science in the end of one style with, I believe, tremendous outcome.
I'm going to take what they call on television when you're watching a court case, a sidebar here, and read a letter that came in prior to the show that's addressed to you. Hi, Dr. Richard. I won't be able to listen at the radio show tomorrow morning since I have to be at work. However, I wonder if you could ask Dr. William L. Courtney if he knows of research or experience in which cannabis helped people with rheumatoid arthritis. The autoimmune disease started on me in 2009, but it has gotten terribly worse since 2011 and extremely worse since mid-2012, to the point where I am always limping a lot and having a torture of a time lifting anything or simply moving. It affects every joint in my body, and there are so many. I used to be very active. I try to heal my rheumatoid arthritis with several natural alternatives, but nothing has worked. I also have two little boys, so I need to be well for them. Any help or guidance will be deeply appreciated. What do you have to say to this person with rheumatoid arthritis?
Rheumatoid arthritis, an autoimmune disorder, is one of the primary functions of cannabis that has been studied quite extensively. There's a woman in Israel who's done a lot of research on rheumatoid, and there are multiple levels of interaction. One is the inflammation. Cannabis is separately patented as an anti-inflammatory. So if you're using it to decrease inflammation and swelling, then you have symptomatic relief. And Brian Whittle identifies ratios of cannabinoids, the amount of CBD to the amount of THC, and identifies specific ratios that are of benefit at different levels for rheumatoid.
Let me just interrupt you for 1 second so you'll explain what CBD is and THC is for our listeners.
Yes. So CBD is cannabidiol. It is a non-psychoactive molecule in both the acidic and the neutral forms. So if you have a plant that's very high in CBD, you can actually heat that plant and not produce a psychoactive effect, because neither CBD acid, the raw plant, or CBD, the heated form, is psychoactive. For 30 years, we've studied CBD, which is the heated form. Just recently, we've begun to look at CBD acid. We know that CBD acid produces twice the bioavailability. We know that it's 300 to 400% more effective at GPR55, which is an anti-inflammatory site. So we're recently switching over to the raw plant. Like I said, there's not a lot of financial incentive to drive that research.
And hasn't the government suppressed research for the past 50 years in this topic, or am I mistaken?
CBD has been identified as a Schedule I drug, which means it has no medical benefits. But CBD is also the subject of a patent held by the United States. So they have intellectual property, and they identify CBD as anti-inflammatory, anti-neoplastic, anti-diabetic.
The government itself holds the patent?
The United States of America Department of Health and Human Services.
I see. Another little sidebar here. Many of you are calling in, and we saw the light is lighting up. We want to give Dr. Courtney a chance to talk for a while, and then there'll be ample opportunity for you to call in. When you do call in, please, the number is 707-937-5103, 707-937-5103. I do ask that you make your questions for Dr. Courtney succinct, concise, to the point, because we have a lot of information to cover. We're even uncertain if we're going to be able to cover it in one interview. So getting back to our person who wrote this letter with regard to rheumatoid arthritis, are you allowed to tell her what she might consider? I don't know what the rules are on talking about something which in and of itself is illegal, and yet there are medicinal uses of it, and it turns out that the it that we're talking about is a non-psychoactive vegetable, which is different than the, quote, marijuana that is typically used for people to change their psyche.
The Supreme Court has allowed physicians to talk about cannabis, but has barred them from aiding and abetting the acquisition. So I can't direct you as to how to acquire or provide it, but I can talk about its benefits, and then you have to turn to the local community to find specific sources and specific, you know, access to the particular plant.
Are you allowed to tell this patient, for example, how much of the vegetable to ingest, non-heated, that is, the non-psychoactive vegetable to ingest in order to get some relief?
Yes.
Are you allowed to do that?
I hope so.
Okay.
Because I do that, and if not, I probably would have heard from someone by this point. There's a lot of research that talks about using CBD at a dose of 5 milligrams per kilogram body weight.
5 milligrams per kilogram. And remember, everybody, there are 2.2 pounds in a kilogram. So people are doing their conversions here, correct?
Yes, so what that turns into, you know, runs in the range of 300 to maybe 1,300 milligrams of CBD a day. The federal patent compares...
About a gram.
Yeah, a gram is an excellent dose. And a half a gram I would be very pleased with, just because it's a difficult molecule, or has been in the past, to get high quantities of, but there are now new strains that are 10, 15, 20% weight-to-weight CBD. And what that means is the current plants, a single flower of a high CBD plant will equal 20 flowers of the plant that we had several years ago, meaning it's easier to grow, and most importantly, it's easier to make palatable, meaning that a single flower you can blend into a drink and not know it's there.
Put it in your morning smoothie.
Exactly.
One flower.
Yes.
And you might be getting a half a gram.
If you're in the 20% weight, the high, the very, very high CBD strains.
I see. Are you allowed to say how a person who's growing vegetables could ensure that they have high CBD in their vegetable in order to use it in a dietary manner, as we're talking about?
There have been a number of analytic labs. There's one in Santa Rosa, the Bay Area, up and down the state. And the analytic labs often are there to demonstrate how much THC is in a plant, because that has been the marketing area of interest until fairly recently.
Because that's where the money is changing the psyche.
That's where the money is.
Yeah.
And the very interesting point is that the whole industry is based on the provision of THC. Whether you're growing and providing it for the dispensaries, you're the dispensary or you're the consumer, roughly 10 milligrams is a good dose of THC. But we're hearing that the non-psychoactive dose is 500 to 1,000. So there are two dramatically different areas of using the plant. And the current medical marijuana community is all about providing 10 milligrams of THC. The consumer is willing to pay $10 for a dose, and that's roughly a dollar a milligram. But as we move to 300, 500, or 1,000 milligrams, the community is going like, we could make 60 or 100 brownies out of that and sell them at $10 a piece. So that's $600 or $1,000. And you want to put that into a glass of juice and drink it like vitamin C and not get high. And so most of my patients grow their own cannabis so that they can be outside of the dollar a milligram loop that really dominates in the quote, medical marijuana community.
Well, yes, the way you're explaining it, it would be cost prohibitive. It would be the most expensive smoothie in the world.
It is the best one in the world, for sure.
And maybe the best one as well. You're listening to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. I'm your host, Dr. Richard Miller. We are privileged today to have Dr. William Courtney on our program, and he's talking about non, and I underline the word non, psychoactive uses of the vegetable known as cannabis.
Could you go back and make a couple more comments about the person, the rheumatoid?
Please.
If you go to Cannabis International and then you go to the patents page.
Cannabisinternational.org. Right.
And then you go to the patents page and you go to the second to last patent. It's by Brian Whittle, a founder of GW Pharmaceuticals. And on table two of that patent, you'll notice different ratios of THC and CBD. When you move to a 3-to-1, you're going to get a significant anti-inflammatory effect, which will provide symptomatic relief in rheumatoid. But when you move to the very high CBD plants, the 95% CBD to 5% THC plants, you actually alter the disease process, meaning you can lower the production of antibodies against the synovial lining and actually have a more therapeutic impact on rheumatoid arthritis. So if you want an autoimmune action, that's different than just the anti-inflammatory. For many people, anti-inflammatories are how rheumatoid is primarily handled, unless you move into some of the more toxic medications that are made available. But cannabis has two different layers of activity. One is symptomatic relief, and then the other is more therapeutic by actually altering the disease process.
If you're suggesting that it's a generalized anti-inflammatory, such as what we use ibuprofen or aspirin for in terms of reducing inflammation in the entire system, this could be extremely significant because, as you well know, the medical literature in recent years is full of the word inflammation because of it seeming to be correlated with various cardiovascular disorders. In fact, I had a surgeon on who did 5,000 open surgeries, cardiovascular and heart surgeries, on not too long ago, and he said he's convinced that the culprit is not cholesterol in terms of atherosclerosis. The culprit is inflammation, because when the little tiny inflammations occur inside the tubes that we call veins and arteries, those inflammation sites are what allows the cholesterol to collect on. You need some kind of a little disturbance, and the inflammation is just the kind of disturbance. And so you're talking about the cannabis vegetable being an anti-inflammatory.
An incredible anti-inflammatory. On that patent page, there's a whole separate patent about cannabinoids as anti-inflammatories.
Give us the reference again. Whipple is his name?
No, Whittle.
Whittle, thank you.
And then there's another patent in addition to his that is entitled cannabinoids as anti-inflammatory. Brian Whittle's is called pharmaceutical formulation, but he talks about the ratios with the information being that you want a very high CBD plant if you want to get a therapeutic effect in rheumatoid arthritis.
We're going to have to come back and talk a lot more about this high CBD, but right now we're going to take a call. Would you put him on, Michael, please? Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Is this the Mind-Body program?
This is Mind-Body Health and Politics. Do you have a quick question
for
Dr. Courtney?
I'm just wondering, it's difficult to get raw vegetable matter, and I'm wondering if alcohol-based tinctures made of it when it's raw could deliver the same thing in a higher concentration.
Thank you. Great question.
I believe that the raw plant is going to be hard to be improved upon, and I encourage my patients to kind of grow the plant in a sequential fashion so that every day they have a mature flower. A very small amount of space is used, but inevitably it comes down to convenience and as well as producing products that make money, and there's a lot of effort to produce tinctures and salves and ointments. And you do, in any of these efforts, want to not use heat. So you want to use a cold extraction. You want to keep it frozen when you're done. And the less that you do, the better. Because one of the molecules, the terpenes, there's monoterpenes, which are small, 10 carbon, and then there's sesqua that are 15 carbon. Those are very delicate molecules that provide the aroma of cannabis. Those terpene molecules are easily lost, and they're there not just to provide the aroma. They actually have a whole series of effects, anti-inflammatory, antiviral, antibacterial themselves, but they also bind to the receptor, the same receptor that the cannabinoids bind to. So you have a terpene acting as a secondary site. It changes the shape of the receptor, increases the binding affinity, increases the duration of action. So you want to keep the terpenes, and so you want to use the plant, seal it in a sealed container, a glass jar, possibly a turkey bag, because you don't want those terpenes sucked out in the freezer. And the idea is that you want to simulate as best possible the raw plant and containing it in as complete a form as possible.
Sealing, you're talking about sealing as best the person can do it, whether it's seal a meal or a special vacuum jar, correct?
Correct. And I think seal a meals may be too soft. Glass is good with a rubber gasket.
Ah.
And possibly turkey bags bound tightly because it's a very dense polymer that the terpenes cannot transfer through.
Good information. William, not too long ago, I had Robert Whitaker on this program, and he talked about the research he did that led to his book, Anatomy of an Epidemic. In the book, he describes how the SSRIs that are proliferating in this country are actually causing mental illness. His thesis there, or what he says he discovered, is that the people that are being given these SSRIs already have normal brain chemistry, even though it was thought that they didn't have normal brain chemistry. You're a trained psychiatrist. You know exactly what I'm talking about. By giving these SSRIs to people who have normal brain chemistry, not abnormal, it created an abnormality. And so what he is claiming is that we are creating mental illness with these pharmaceutical drugs. Recently, at a national conference of the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws, NORML, Dr. David Berman of the American Academy of Cannabinoid Medicine suggested that CBD, what you're talking about, is an antidepressant, which may have many fewer side effects than pharmaceutical depression medications. Will you comment on that, please?
At 30 milligrams per kilogram, at a much higher dose, it has the efficacy of imipramine. And imipramine is the classic tricyclic against which the SRIs must go toe-to-toe to establish that they can be sold to the American public because they demonstrate efficacy. So CBD definitely acts as an antidepressant. The first compassionate use as an investigative new drug was for psychosis in Parkinson's, and the federal patent repeatedly refers to CBD as being an anti-anxiety. And what causes anxiety in Western medical physicians is how can one drug be an anti-anxiety, an antidepressant, an antipsychotic, an anti-ischemic, an anti-diabetic, an anti-neoplastic. And it drove, I had a very hard time with that for years because I'm a silver bullet trained person. Penicillin blocks a cell wall, stops a bacteria, you know, single action, single effect. And all of a sudden here you're looking at a molecule that appears to be affecting everything. And it's key to know that we now have a mechanism on that. We have this system called intracrine, which is intracellular regulation, and that these cannabinoids receptors, CB1, CB2, and this orphan receptor, are inside the cell. They're inside, they're on the nuclear membrane, they're on the mitochondria, they're on the endoplasmic reticulum, the endosomes, lysosomes, Golgi apparatus, the whole internal milieu of the cell, the homeostatic function. The nucleus provides information. It moves into the endoplasmic reticulum where a product is produced, acid for the stomach.
But all of them are receptors, or what do you say?
These receptors are regulating and making sure that there's enough energy produced by the mitochondria to fulfill the directions of the nucleus for that particular cell type. And then so you end up improving. I call cannabis now a homeostatin. It helps restore homeostasis in the 210 types of cells that have been identified that are the various categories of the 70 trillion cells of the body. So you end up, it doesn't really matter what the cell's doing, it just helps it do it more effectively. Whether it's identifying self and non-self for cancer detection, glucose metabolism in the area of insulin resistance, circulation, contractility, secretion, whatever the cell is doing, it helps it to do it more effectively.
What about Berman's claims that CBD can reduce, he says they can reduce the invasiveness of cancer cells, and he credits CBD as a therapy for epilepsy, inflammation, pain, post-traumatic stress disorder, and psychosis. How does he make these claims? Does he have clinical data? What does he have? Where is he coming from?
I have patients in all of those areas. I have patients that have been left to the side by Western medicine for cancer, for seizures, that have found tremendous relief with these non-psychoactive molecules that help the cells function more effectively. Dravet, it's a single amino acid substitution in the sodium channel. These kids have, you know, can have hundreds of seizures a day. One of my patients had been...
You're talking about Dravet syndrome.
I have a number of patients with that. I've had children with cancer that were sent home on hospice and morphine that, you know, I'm seeing around the village now. I've got another child who had a massive brain tumor and avoided chemotherapy and used these cannabinoids to destroy the nucleus and the cancer cells. The cancers went away. They avoided the long-term consequences of chemotherapy and radiation. And that is stunning.
The person saying that is Dr. William Courtney. He's an international expert on non-psychoactive dietary uses of cannabis. You're hearing him talk about case studies from his own files, which are extremely dramatic. We're going to take a call right now. Michael, please put them on. Hi, welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. You're on the air.
Good morning, Richard Miller and Dr. Courtney. I'm calling to let folks know that Lovin' It Cooperative has fresh frozen leaf juice. If there are any people out there who are patients, 215 patients, and they'd like some leaf juice, we have it at Lovin' It.
Thank you very much for calling. What is she referring to? What's leaf juice, Dr. Courtney?
I've had one child who spent a year in a pediatric oncology ward, had 39 hours of brain surgery, chemotherapy 10 times lethal, bone marrow transplant, 42 days of focused radiation under general anesthesia, then sent home on hospice to Fort Bragg, and local pediatrician began juiced raw leaf. And this child has now passed 4 or 5 MRIs, is off of hospice, escaped, you know, all but a very, you know, turned their whole life around. And so that is the way that we use the plant until maybe a couple of years ago when we started to add the raw flower. And the reason that the flower was added later was the fear was that it was psychoactive, and it came as quite a shock that the mature flower, you can eat 100 times more of it than you can smoke. So before that, we were using just the leaf to stay non-psychoactive, and that by itself is quite remarkable.
Suppose somebody is listening to this and they say, wow, this stuff, this sounds really terrific. This is a real doctor, and he's got real case studies, and I'm listening to this, and I'm going to go out and do it. And they go out, and they grow a plant in their backyard, and they grind it up. They listen to what you have to say, and they don't heat it up, and they keep it, you know, cool. And so they've got a non-psychoactive vegetable. Can they overdose? In other words, if they put it in their salad, suppose, you know, some people take the view a little is good, a lot is even better, and they make a giant salad. Can they overdose? Can they hurt themselves?
There's not been a fatality that we know of associated with cannabis. The overdosing always goes to THC. That's, once it's been heated, produces a psychoactive effect. By 10 milligrams is a comfortable dose for someone who enjoys THC. By 20 milligrams, there's staggering and slurring. By 30, the person has difficulty standing up. And so the overdose is very common with THC, and most individuals have done that once, and most individuals do not do it twice because it's very unpleasant.
Just as an aside here, for those who are using it to change their psychology, not the dietary people that this program is predominantly about, but for those people who are wanting to change their psychology, are there some warning signs, or does this, like everybody on the street, know what the warning signs are when you're starting to get into a toxic dose because you either ate too much, which would be easy to do. It would be much easier, I would think, to get toxic eating it because you don't know how much you're eating than toxic smoking it because each time you take a puff, I imagine you feel the feeling and you know whether to go further, correct?
Correct. So if you are inhaling it, it's going straight into the arterial system. Whereas if you eat it, it has to be absorbed. It has to go by the liver in a first pass effect. You have about a 10% bioavailability with eating it because so much of it is taken out before it gets to the arterial system. And then the delay is that you continue to absorb it for hours. And so the problem is young folks may eat a brownie and say, well, that's not affecting me. I'll have another one. Well, that's not very strong. I'll have another one. And they'll eat three or four brownies before the first one has begun to have an effect. And that creates, you know, an overdose state. And like I said, you generally only do that once because it is so unpleasant.
Tell us some of the symptoms of an overdose state, please.
There appears to be some age-related conditions. Younger folks tend to have states of derealization. They feel that they don't feel safe. They feel that their body is not in good shape because they can't stand up. And as we grow older, the cardiovascular system, you end up with an increased heart rate and anxiety that quickly moves into a paranoia and a tremendous uncomfortable state.
What's the physiological mechanism that's causing the paranoia?
It's probably a dopamine effect. There's a lot of information that the cannabinoids, in particular THC, and so we're now talking about THC, which is a synthetic molecule made by heating and is to be distinguished from cannabis. It is, it's a product of human intervention.
Maybe we shouldn't go too far into this topic today, and let's get back to the dietary. That's
correct.
Another whole topic of educating the public about the psychoactive marijuana. We'll talk about that separately, but I see the phone is ringing off the hook here, so we'll take another call. Excuse me. Go ahead. Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I had two quick questions.
Okay.
One is, I guess the first one would be, is there any such thing as being, you've just waited too long, you haven't gotten help from the medical stuff, you're older, you've got pretty much, you know, all the symptoms and problems, and you've just been, just enduring and enduring. So is there any, contraindication for too far gone? Too messed up. And then the other question
Excuse me one second. Are you saying contraindications for this vegetable, non-psychoactive use
exactly.
of cannabis? Thank you. Okay,
yes.
we understand that.
Okay.
Next.
Okay, and then my other question is,
yes.
is there any thing like, I did get some good quality seeds, and I'm trying to build a greenhouse so that I can do, grow my own, because I haven't been able to get what I need to eat. And I've used a little bit, and it worked really good. And for pain, it goes right to the pain. I love that because nothing else does. Anyway.
And you are definitely not heating it up.
No. That was just raw.
Raw leaf. Vegetable.
Just raw leaf. But
Excellent.
Anyway, so my other specific question is, if I do get it together and I'm able to, help myself and use it, eat it for a long time, does he have any studies that have gone on long enough to where, you've gotten help and you're doing better and you're back on your track, and then if you stop doing it and you keep the rest of your life kind of together enough, do you start
deteriorating? Thank you. That's a great question. You get what she's asking.
Definitely.
She wants to know, do you have to give this industry an annuity and use it forever, or do you can you use it for a while and stop?
No, you want to mortgage your house and use it forever. This is a homeostatin. It helps the cells of your body do whatever they're doing a little more effectively, and that includes everything that is life. It's done at the cellular level, and these cannabinoids just help the cells perform that task more effectively. Now, say you have a cancer, and I've had patients who have come from states that have zero tolerance. They come out here, and they use a lot of raw cannabis. They go back to the Mayo Clinic. They do a CAT scan. They go, like, what happened to all of your stage 4 pulmonary metastatic locations? They're just, the metastasis are gone. And then the person lives in a state where it's not available, and 3 to 4 months later, the tumor is back.
People want to live in a state where there's zero tolerance.
You know, all of your family's there, your house is there, your business is there. I mean, just the. But it is, if you have a very serious condition and it's helping, say, a deficiency in identifying that this particular cell, that the person who has cancer, their immune system says, well, that cell's part of me, it's normal, it's fine, and it allows it to grow. And then what cannabis appears to do is help the immune system say, oh, that's not, that's a proliferation, that's an atypical cell, and then it destroys the nuclear membrane, the cells evaporate, and the cancer just goes away. And the cannabis helps maintain that level of orientation to detect that particular type of cancer, but in general it also helps other conditions, and it helps reduce diabetes, heart attacks.
Based on your research now, what you're recommending is a bud a day keeps the doctor away.
Yes, and if you got a lot of doctors around you, then you probably need to do a pile of buds until you get your health back, and then maintain a standard to keep them at bay.
And that was tongue-in-cheek, everybody. Keep it in mind. Here's another letter I'm going to read. Dr. Richard, I really enjoy your broadcast. Would it be possible to ask Dr. Courtney about the value and effects of cannabis to combat insomnia? Not sure if you remember, but I had a terrible time for almost 10 years with insomnia and then trying to get off prescription drugs such as Ambien, etc. Smoking marijuana at night helped me get off this, and now I'm using it in the oil form, parenthesis, as per Rick Simpson, I think. And I'm using Canacig, electronic cigarette. I think my only concern health-wise is what damage I may be doing to my respiratory system. I would appreciate the doc's input.
Donald Taskin out of UCLA had been involved in trying to find if cannabis smoke produced cancers. And it seemed like it was going to be an assured thing, because you inhale more of the polyaromatic hydrocarbons that are potential carcinogen, and then the way you inhale and hold it, you deposit more tars because of the smoking behavior. So you have two elements that would suggest that you would have cancers. Well, he went ahead and did a study of like 600 people with oropharyngeal cancer and 600 with pulmonary cancer, and a controlled double-blind crossover study with 1,200 people that did not have cancer, and he found that there was no correlation with cancer. In fact, there was a negative correlation, and Donald Abrams in San Francisco, when this data was presented, said the negative correlation kind of implies that the cannabis is actually protecting the individual from carcinogens in the air. So if you lived in Los Angeles, the anti-neoplastic effect of smoking, not only it doesn't produce lung cancers, but actually has a positive net effect. Now, I'm not a big proponent on smoking, but there's also shown that there is no increase in COPD. You do have a thermal bronchitis, which is the cough, but that's transient. But in terms of the big pulmonary conditions, pulmonary cancer, COPD, there is no association. Even for people that do smoke, like I think it was up to 10,000 joints, there is no correlation between heavy use and
they found someone who smoked 10,000 joints.
Yeah.
And put that person on record.
Yeah,
that's
heavy.
What can I say?
Yeah, and that person did not have evidence of pulmonary damage. I mean, like I said, you do have the thermal bronchitis and the cough, and that the heat has an adverse effect on the bronchi.
I would think their lip alone would be worn out.
Yeah, that or built up.
I've treated people who have had their lips worn out from smoking various things, cigars and cigarettes, just went know, a groove in their lip from smoking it, putting it in there over and over again. We have another call here. Let's take that one, Michael, please. Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a question. I'm curious if I'm mixing cannabis as a vegetable into a salad and I use an oil salad dressing or a milk-based salad dressing, if that would make it psychoactive.
Thank you very much. Yeah, interesting question.
Nothing will make it psychoactive except for heat, basically, and certainly not oil or milk. If you're going to be making a smoothie with it, we do know that the cannabinoid acids are more fat soluble, and so you want a drink that has a high fat content. If you start out with hemp milk, put the bud in there, toss in some hemp nut, blend that up, and then put in flavorings, the carrying capacity of the smoothie is 50 to 60 times higher if it's a fatty drink than if it's a water-based drink. And the problem with the water-based is that these cannabinoid acids cannot go into solution, and so they're out of phase. They're stuck in the sludge at the bottom, on the side of the blender, and the foam at the top, because the water is completely saturated, but there's a whole bunch more acids that can't go into solution, and so those are easily lost. But with a fatty drink, these cannabinoid acids can dissolve into the fatty drink, and you're less likely to lose them accidentally in the process of making the smoothie.
Otherwise, you're recommending that someone use a nice rubber spatula and get every drop off the side of the inside of the smoothie glass, eh?
And if you decide to add hemp oil, only do that for a particular dose, because say you make up enough juice for the whole day, and we haven't talked about that, but the cannabinoid acids and the neutrals clear in 50 minutes. You absorb them for a couple hours. So essentially, you want to be doing a couple ounces of juice every 3 to 4 hours all day long. It's called browsing. And every other animal on the planet is comfortable with it. It's not real compatible with human, you know, kind of the way we live our life. But small amounts are often are necessary. And the nice part is that it allows you to change the ratios. A deer can eat 5 different plants a day. One that could be very high in CBD, one's 1-to-1, one's 3-to-1, one's 1-to-3. And we do know that these different ratios have an impact on particular physiologic systems. And so that the rapid clearance is actually a good thing, except for how do humans learn to browse? And that really becomes a bit of a lifestyle shift where, and this all began with, if you're going to put hemp oil in, if you blend that in a high-speed blender, that oil becomes acrid. If it's 6 to 8 hours out. So make the whole blended drink in the morning, put 2/3 in the refrigerator, take 1/3, put in a couple tablespoons of hemp oil if you want, but consume that blended hemp oil straight away before it goes acrid.
What about the speed of the blades of the blender creating heat enough to take the CBD and turn it into THC?
And I'm someone who doesn't like a lot of fiber, and so I'm inclined to do whatever it takes to make a clear drink. And if you do cook it, and that there's a very, very serious consequence of this, because you toss a whole mature flower into a drink, and people that do smoke, they smoke a very small portion of a flower, and all of a sudden you're putting in 50 to 60 times the amount of plant material. And if that drink is accidentally put into a soup or a stew by someone who doesn't know what's in there, you could have 50 to 60 brownies in that pot of soup. Each bowl has 10 to 15. You'd be very, very, very overdosed.
What about my question, though, on the blades? Spinning?
Yeah, the blades, yeah. You want to put in some ice chips if you can do it for long. You want to keep it cold. I always refrigerate the hemp milk and the other things I put in it, so I have cold hemp seed, hemp milk. You do not want to cook this plant. We must be aware that these blenders, you put them in there because you want it really smooth. You go someplace else, you come back, you're gonna have 40 or 50 brownies. Be very careful.
Underlining in red, one of the themes of this entire program is that heat is to be avoided if you're looking for a dietary, non-psychoactive vegetable use of cannabis. Heat is to be avoided.
And particularly because these dietary doses are, 500 milligrams.
Yeah.
That's 50 brownies. 1,000 milligrams, that's 100 brownies. So you can't underline it in red enough that if you're going to do mature flower,
sure,
you have to do it the way animals have done it for 34 million years. It has to be raw.
I know one of the dangers of the brownies, of course, is that since it takes somewhere between 30 and 60 minutes for the effect of the psychoactive cannabis in the brownie to take effect. Sometimes people eat it. They think nothing's happening. Then they eat some more. Then they eat some more, waiting, and then all of a sudden it hits. I know of a case where a person ate an entire brownie, and then the effect started while they were on the San Rafael Bridge down in the Bay Area, and then they were driving, and it came on, and it was quite a thing to control.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the person did was able to, but it could have been quite dangerous. I've got another letter to read to you here. Dr. Miller, what class of marijuana does your guest advise for nerve pain, i.e. trigeminal neuralgia? And also, what type make you feel paranoid and hyperactive?
Well, we'll start with the second question first. Plants that are high in THC acid do not do that, but if they're heated, they create the THC, and the THC creates that anxiety, paranoia, racing heart, blood pressure issues.
I have a theory about that I want to share with you, William, about what causes that paranoia. When the heart rate increases rapidly, all of a sudden pulse goes up, and blood pressure increases rapidly, as it does in these high doses that can happen for a short period of time, most people, when they feel, I think, an increase in blood pressure and an increase in heart rate, instead of going inside and quieting themselves down, they're trained to look out, you know, what's causing this out there in the world that might be doing this, or where it is. Well, when you're looking outside for yourself for something that's causing something inside yourself, that is almost the definition of paranoia.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a sympathomimetic, and it's a very potent one. So that fight or flight reaction produces the same effect. So
exactly.
You feel the effect, and you say, well, I must be in fight or flight, and you end up with
something
those feelings.
Scary. All right, second question was the one about nerve pain and trigeminal neuralgia.
If you go back to the Brian Whittle patent, table 2 at cannabisinternational.org, you'll see that he talks about a ratio of 1:1, which is a 50% CBD to 50% THC, and that is good for MS, peripheral neuropathies, spinal cord injuries. It appears to have some ability to kind of help the nerve, maybe a damaged membrane, reconstitute rather than become the victim of microglia and be absorbed and removed. So the neuronal issues, I think, are the best place to begin is with a balanced ratio.
Well, we're coming to the end of our program. I can hardly thank you enough for being with us today. As we discussed before the program, I think this might be the beginning of a series that we can bring to our listeners on the non-psychoactive uses of the vegetable cannabis. Thank you so much for being with us today, William.
A pleasure's mine.
I hope you'll come back. Yeah. So we're coming to the end of our broadcast, and this was quite a topic today, wasn't it? Because for so many of us, everything we know about this has to do with some form of smoking it or eating it in order to cause a psychological effect that evidently something like 30 million people in the United States want to enjoy or feel that they're enjoying enough to have. But today we've been talking about something completely different. We're talking about non-psychoactive, a non-psychoactive cannabis that when you eat doesn't feel any different than broccoli, asparagus, kale, bok choy, various other vegetables. It's a whole new paradigm. What do we think about that? Is this something that just a small group of scientists in the world are revealing to us? Or what is it? And why is it that the United States government for 50 years has actively been suppressing research? And by the way, not just suppressing research, say, in your garage or in your living room, the United States government has been suppressing research actively at the highest level of university scientists. Why is that? What do you think is going on there? Furthermore, I know personally from my travels that the United States government is also suppressing research by other countries. The way our government does this is by telling these other countries that if they engage in such research, they will lose money that we back them with. It's a form of sanctioning. Why is this going on? What kind of country are we turning into? These are important questions for us to ask ourselves because our mental health and our physical health are all part of our health. We can't have one without the other. We're all unified beings. Well, thank you for listening to today's broadcast of Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, which is made possible by our staff at KZYX and our in-studio engineer, my friend Mike DeLaura. Please join me in again next week, not 2 weeks, but next week at 9 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. Until then, this is Dr. Richard Miller reminding you that good health is worth fighting for, and it's essential for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.